Thank you, John and Amber. Did you work up a sweat? Good morning, and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. If this is one of your first times here, or your first time here, there will be a chance later on to introduce yourself. We don't require it, don't worry. We'll just look at you and make you uncomfortable. But we don't require it. Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society prides itself on being a welcoming congregation. We welcome you, no matter where you are on the religious spiritual journey, no matter what your ethnicity, no matter your color of your skin, no matter your gender identification, your family structure, we welcome you. Our services are different every Sunday, so if this is one of your first times, come back and try it out again. Services are sometimes led by me, Sandy Ingham, the minister here at Prairie, often by outside speakers, such as today's speaker, more about that in a moment, and sometimes by people from within the congregation. I have a brief announcement. Some of you may know this if you're on Facebook enough. I have put up two very old-fashioned ways to communicate, two newspaper clippings on the bulletin in the back, which were printed this week in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about what's happening with banners that Unitarian Universalist congregations are putting up that say Black Lives Matter. They're being vandalized, and it was a lot of publicity for Unitarian Universalists this past week in Wisconsin, and I always say all publicity is good publicity. All publicity matters. It's my great, great pleasure to introduce a dear friend of mine, the Reverend Scott Jared Prinster, who is this morning's speaker. Scott and I were at Star King School for the Ministry together, so we seem to be kind of following each other around, but he's losing me now because he's finishing his dissertation at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The dissertation is on the historical relationship between religion and science in the United States. Scott has served congregations in Michigan and Wisconsin, and I love this, taught English for 2 years at the Unitarian Cemetery. It's the heat. You weren't teaching it there, were you? At the Unitarian Seminary in Transylvania. Before he went to Star King School for the Ministry, his background was in physics, and he worked as a NASA contractor for the space program. He is a man of many talents, and I invite you to welcome him as he begins the service.
Good morning. You all get extra points in Unitarian heaven for showing up on such a hot day. The coffee will be fair trade and iced in heaven, I promise. Let's begin with these words. We are gathered not to petition the universe to magically change our circumstances, not to single us out for special blessings, but to see our lives with new eyes, to tell a different story about our lives' meaning. May the spirit of clarity and gratitude pervade this community of seekers that we recognize and cultivate our abundant lives. The Sufi poet Rumi wrote, "Secretly we spoke, that wise one and me. I said, tell me the secrets of the world. He said, shh, let silence tell you the secrets of the world." May the peace and comfort of silence strengthen all our lives. Our reading this morning is from that great popularizer of science, Stephen Jay Gould, in his introduction to Carl Zimmer's book, Evolution, The Triumph of an Idea. Gould writes, "No scientific revolution can match Darwin's discovery in degree of upset to our previous comforts and certainties. In the only conceivable challenge, Copernicus and Galileo moved our cosmic location from the center of the universe to a small and peripheral body orbiting a central sun. But this cosmic reorganization only fractured our concept of real estate. Darwinian evolution, on the other and deeper hand, revolutionized our view of our own meaning and essence, insofar as science can address such questions at all. Who are we? How did we get here? How are we related to other creatures, and in what manner? Evolution substituted a naturalistic explanation of cold comfort for our former conviction that a benevolent deity fashioned us directly in his own image, to have dominion over the entire earth and all other creatures." I'm generally a level-headed sort of person, I like to think, and I think that I'm able to roll with the changes most of the time, but I have to acknowledge that I find certain transitions especially tough to weather. A few weeks ago, my roommates announced that our landlord was not renewing our lease and that I'd have to find a new place to live by the end of July. Even I was taking care of the business of finding a new apartment and applying for a lease, I was gradually realizing how poorly rested and short-tempered I was becoming. Being a graduate student, I've had to move 5 times in the last 9 years as my roommates graduated or married, and I've come to realize that I'd rather stay in an unappealing situation than be uprooted one more time. Humans are creatures of habit, but we also change jobs, marry or divorce, have children, lose people we love, and experience our own aging and illness. Sometimes changes are forced upon us by our environment, and sometimes they arise from within us, inspiring excitement and uncertainty at new beginnings, and perhaps anxiety and sadness at what we're leaving behind. This morning, I invite you to join me in exploring just how intellectually and spiritually significant it is that we are part of an ever-changing world, and how important it is that we make our peace with the reality of this change. To appreciate just how fundamental an idea it is that the world is undergoing constant change, we need to understand how differently early humanity saw their world. One of the courses I teach at the University of Wisconsin is the history of ancient and medieval science, where we learned that the reality of a changing world was one of the first challenges that ancient Greek thinkers had to face. When the philosopher Heraclitus said, "You can never step in the same river twice," he was acknowledging the difficulty of understanding a world that never stays the same. The Greeks created a thought problem known as the Ship of Theseus to wrestle with this question. If Theseus replaces the old sails on his ship, is it still the same ship? What about if he replaces the hull? What about if he replaces the deck? You get the point. How do we say that we know something when it is always in the process of becoming something else? I like to joke that we should have the Toyota Camry of Scott Prinster thought problem, because at this point, surely it is a new car with how many new parts I've had to put into it. In any case, the Greeks feared that their new philosophy might be useless if it couldn't produce solid knowledge. This may seem like a silly paradox to consider, especially in light of the number of genuinely urgent concerns clamoring for our attention. But I can't emphasize enough how powerfully this question has shaped Western culture and we are still wrestling with its repercussions today. The ancient Greeks responded to this intellectual challenge by describing the universe as composed of two worlds. One, the world of material objects, in which everything changes and decays, and the world of unchanging eternal ideas and forms. Although most of us don't think much about Greek philosophy on a daily basis, this two-world perspective becomes especially influential as a cornerstone of the Christian church. This is how Western culture inherited the idea that humans are composed of a physical changing body and an eternal unchanging soul or mind. This is also how we inherited the concept of a transcendent, unchanging God out there, beyond this flawed, decaying world. For many centuries, Western civilization has been built around this idea of a perfect divine being watching over all of creation, because we wanted so much to be able to identify at least some part of the universe that did not confuse us by constantly changing. Furthermore, because the church taught that the universe was an expression of God's own rationality, it's not surprising that Christians viewed the arrangement of all things as also perfect and unchanging. It was common to describe creation as a hierarchy called the great chain of being, classifying all creatures in order of their complexity. At the top, God, then angels, demons, humans, other animals in order of complexity, then plants, and finally inanimate minerals. The consequence of this great chain of being was that although each individual is constantly changing, living, growing, reproducing, and dying, each type of organism remains the same and continues to occupy the same place on that ladder. That is, although cats grow, change, and die, they only give birth to other cats and not to, say, daisies or ostriches. Again, this arrangement was an important part of believing that we could really only understand our world if some essential parts of it remained unchanging. It was when naturalists noticed that the similarities between different kinds of organisms made them think about the possibility of evolution. Erasmus Darwin, the infamous grandfather of the famous Charles Darwin, noticed that so many different mammals seem to spend their entire lives doing all the same things: moving, consuming, competing, reproducing, and dying, which could be explained if they had all arisen from the same source, from some ancient ancestor. This challenge to the traditional view of perfect, unchanging creation was controversial enough that Erasmus Darwin's work was placed on the Catholic Church's list of banned books. Not long after, the French naturalist Jean-Baptiste Lamarck speculated that animals could develop new characteristics to help them survive and then pass these adaptations on to their offspring. The popular example we often use in the classroom is of giraffes stretching their necks to reach better leaves higher in the trees, gradually developing slightly longer necks and giving birth to offspring with this same slight advantage. Of course, it's Charles Darwin who promoted his version of evolution with such success and controversy. Darwin's insight was that organisms naturally vary, and that the more advantageous variations are passed along more successfully than the lesser qualities. For example, not everyone in my family is of the same height. And if we could imagine that height somehow offered an advantage in producing more offspring, then we could imagine future generations very gradually reflecting this advantage. Of course, since Darwin's painstaking research was conducted before we understood genetics, he didn't know how these characteristics were being passed on, only that they were. Over enormous spans of time, the first very simple life forms that first populated the Earth, diversified and complexified into an entire planet of organisms very different from those most ancient ancestors. Anti-evolutionists have objected fearfully that this approach and these conclusions would undermine the religious activities of wonder and reverence and would destroy the very moral foundations of our civilization. However, I want to return to my original observation of how sensitive we are to the changes in our lives and how this sensitivity inspires us not only to adapt biologically, but also to respond in ways that we might describe as spiritual or religious. For example, in response to a number of anti-evolution policies passed by a school board in Grantsburg, Wisconsin, a decade ago, a campaign called the Clergy Letter Project was established by biologist Michael Zimmerman and United Church of Christ minister John McFadden. In addition to collecting signatures from clergy and leaders of various faiths in support of evolutionary teachings, the group also sponsors an annual evolution weekend each February to encourage dialogue and new forms of collaboration between religion and science. Although we're accustomed to hearing in the popular media that religion and science are naturally incompatible and are necessarily at war, there are plenty of opportunities to see how religious concerns are influenced positively by the evolutionary world. Our own movement has a long history of trying to make religious sense of the evidence for evolution. One of the ways in which our religious forebears distinguished themselves from other traditions was by acknowledging which parts of our beliefs have changed over time and which truths remained permanent. Unlike almost any other movement in the 19th century, Unitarians acknowledged that religious knowledge could change over time too, and that they need not feel threatened every time a new discovery was made. This, in fact, is the topic of the first two chapters of my dissertation, so it's on my mind a lot, every day. Later leaders took this conversation even further, stating that not only could evolution be tolerated by religion, but that it could actually strengthen our religious questioning. Minneapolis Universalist minister Marion Shutter delivered a series of 12 lectures in 1900 called Applied Evolution, in which he explored the overlap between science and the kind of religion that would be able to meet the needs of the modern world. To audiences of more than 1,000 people, he explained the three ways that religion has actually benefited from the contributions of science. First, that religion can learn from the sciences to emphasize facts rather than wishful thinking and adopt methods that produce factual conclusions. Second, religion can expect that its conclusions will not violate our common sense. And third, religion can learn to stop defending doctrines simply because they're traditional, relying instead on factual evidence as its trustworthy benchmark. Shutter concluded his lectures by reassuring his audiences, "We have not lost God. We have only lost an old idea of God's way of doing things. The God of evolution is inside of nature and not outside of it." As seekers have embraced the idea of science being part of our spiritual toolkit, we have the opportunity to push our questioning even further. One of the stories I love to tell about the consequence of our questioning is about the fisherman who pulled his catch from the sea every day using a net with 3-inch mesh and concluding that the ocean contained no fish smaller than 3 inches. The lenses we look through partly determine what we're able to see. And it's here that I want to pause and acknowledge how this conversation is not just an intellectual exercise, but touches on the most pressing concerns of our lives. The grief and rage of Ferguson and Baltimore and our own Madison remind us that we have not stopped being afraid of change, and that we still have some difficult truths to face about American society. I marched in Ferguson with other UUs last Sunday and was reminded so vividly how we are clinging to old beliefs about ourselves and our nation that no longer match the reality around us, if in fact they ever did. If religion is not going to fade into irrelevance, it needs to be able to provide meaningful insights into a world that changes, rather than falling back on the same platitudes written 20 centuries ago. Some modern philosophers have concluded that evolution is such a fundamental principle in how the world operates that it's time for us to rethink even our most basic religious assumptions. The philosopher Charles Hartshorne, for example, introduced a system of thought called process theology, in which the very foundation of all reality, whether we call it God, natural law, the ground of all being, is not some unchanging exception outside the flow of time, but also evolves alongside the events of history. Hartshorne argued that conventional Christian theology depended too much on ancient Greek philosophy, and so on the desire to find something permanent beyond our ever-changing world. This early mistake left the church with several fundamental misunderstandings that continue to haunt Christianity even today. The errors that Hartshorne identifies include, one, that God must be perfect and therefore unchanging, unchangeable, in fact. Two, that God is omnipotent, meaning that everything that happens was meant to happen. Three, that God is omniscient, therefore never gaining new knowledge, and that whatever freedom of decision we humans have cannot impact God's experience. Four, that God's goodness does not involve sympathy. Some have compared this to the sun's way of doing good by supporting life on earth but not being changed by us. In my mind, a very strange description to call goodness. And lastly, that some individuals have gained such a clear and trustworthy revelation about religion that we cannot ever question or update their claims. I recognize that God language is not meaningful to all of us, but I like how Hartshorne's observations help us to see how easily our desire for permanence can move us to cling to ideas that are not ultimately useful, and in fact, are often destructive. Evolutionary thought threatens to uproot these ancient errors and demand that religion be compatible with what we've learned from our everyday experience of the world. What a difference it would make if religion were not held captive by dogma that denies the reality of our lives. What a difference if it could help us respond to a world that refuses to sit still for us. As Carl Zimmer wrote in our reading this morning, no scientific discovery has upset the comforts and certainties from our past as thoroughly as Darwin's. No other intellectual revolution has so thoroughly revealed the weakness at the heart of how religion has traditionally functioned. Even though it might be human nature to want to ignore that the world around us and within us is constantly evolving, we have so much to gain by embracing the science and spirituality that acknowledges change as a basic truth, as basic as the laws of nature. And because the best services, in my opinion, are the ones that draw upon the facts of your lives and your experiences, I want to leave you with these questions to ponder further. How do your thinking and acting acknowledge the shifting demands of a changing world? What gets in the way of you embracing change? What makes it possible for you to embrace change? How can this community be a place that responds to the world as it actually is, and not how we might wish it was? Again, the truths of evolution remind us that life is a story that is constantly being written. And I invite you to join me in making it a story that is true. May it be so. We invite you to join us now in a time of dialogue. Yes, extinction was a central sticking point for people in embracing evolutionary thought. In the early 1800s, books were being written that were popularly published and distributed. Scandalous books that claimed that humans too may have been the product of evolution just like everything else. But the sticking point was this: we didn't have good enough evidence that creatures were going extinct. And so there was no sign that there was ever a need for new creatures, for new varieties to emerge. We have, as humans, an amazing ability to hide our eyes from things that we don't want to see. One example is when we would find fossilized shark's teeth many, many years before Darwin, we simply rationalized that those were a very interesting form of crystals that just happened to be exactly the same shape as living shark's teeth. But the discovery of large mammals like mastodons, for example, were undeniable, because how could you miss a mastodon if they were still walking among us, right? Small animals, again, you could kind of justify and sweep those under the rug, but something the size of a truck, you couldn't really deny that we were not seeing those anymore. And so the discovery of extinct species and archaeological evidence of very ancient human civilizations, when Napoleon invaded Egypt, he commandeered, he liberated, in the American form of language, many, many pieces of archaeological evidence that humanity was much, much older than the 6,000 years we had claimed from interpreting the Bible. So yes, extinction was a major step forward for us, and there was no good answer to it. I mean, the only obvious response people tried to make was, well, God put those fossils there to tempt us. And yes, you respond as I do, like, no, that's lame, that's not going to work. Well, I want to agree with you totally on the movie Creation. It is, it's not a rigorous history of Darwin's life. It's a sensationalized history, and so it's fictionalized, but it's so well done. It's, as you said, Paul Bettany and Jennifer Connelly, excellent actors. You really get a sense of Darwin's emotional struggles with whether he should put this message out into the scientific world. And I actually show a clip of it to my students when I teach the middle course in our survey, which is Newton to Einstein, because it shows Darwin and his wife fighting over these conflicting worldviews, his factually based worldview versus her sort of faith-based view. And this is, you know, this is sort of the foundation that we're struggling with, that if your worldview is essentially based on faith statements, then no factual argument is probably going to sway you. What I find is that people who believe in evolution or people who believe in divine creation typically have not looked closely at the evidence in either party. Most ordinary people don't spend a lot of time and energy reading evolutionary texts because they're difficult and they're maybe boring. What people tend to do is evolutionists tend to believe evolution because people they trust believe evolution, and creationists tend to believe the biblical creation because people they trust believe the biblical message. And so what we are doing in Madison, in fact, there is a community, an astonishing community called BioLogos, evangelical Christians who are pro-evolution, who are trying to spread evolutionary thought through the evangelical movements, which is an amazing task. They believe that evolution is God's gift, that God created a universe that is so embedded with complexity and possibility that it simply unfurls and flowers to become everything that we have around us. And for them, that's a source of wonder and gratitude and reverence. And I'm not an evangelical, but when I hear that, I'm like, yeah, yeah. I wouldn't word it exactly like that, but I recognize that sense of just awe and gratitude when I'm in nature and I recognize just the astonishing diversity and complexity and interrelatedness of it. But to try to argue them down using the arguments of the opposing camp typically does not succeed. It's very frustrating to bridge those two worlds, I find. This is one of the challenges of trying to disseminate science popularly, is that typically people will not believe something unless they can see it happening right before their eyes. And even then, maybe not. That this was one of the problems that Darwin faced, that science before Darwin had been essentially, you proved your point by collecting enormous lists of facts and just looked for the patterns that emerged from it. Darwin made a systematic use of what we call a hypothesis or theory to say, I believe that it's actually natural selection that's causing evolution, the evolution that we're seeing, rather than a divine creation of species with a magic wand. And American culture in particular really absorbed that earlier view of evidence. And so there are still people who say that evolution is non-scientific. It is an unscientific theory because you can't just sit down and watch it happen before your eyes. So it's a very simplistic understanding of nature, obviously. And what Ari is pointing out is even beyond the long-term genetic changes that evolution addresses, there are processes that are constantly in play. Within the human body, we often call them epigenetic. So they're chemicals that are flowing through our bodies that are also inherited by our offspring. And there are processes out in the earth, out in nature, that are not contained within any one thing where you can look at it under a microscope, but are nevertheless, as he said, responsible for regulating and maintaining a nature that we can survive in. So it is one of the most critical and urgent things facing. That is such a rich and wonderful question. I'll try not to go on at length about it, but I need to confess that's something I get very excited about. And my students hear a lot about it because they think, oh, Plato's view of the world, that's cute. He's, you know, that's just silly. What does that matter to us? I'm like, oh, you don't know. As you said, it elevates mind and spirit over the body, and the repercussions of that are enormous. It has led to the vilification of women's bodies, people of color's bodies, gay and lesbian bodies, sexuality, physicality and sensuality in general, labor. So there's a class distinction that has arisen out of that same distinction. It's enormous in Western culture how profoundly shaped we are by this one single idea, because the church really, really promoted it. Now, I don't know if Aristotelian thought would be a big improvement, because where you see that, the Catholic Church is a product of the Scholastics, which was Aristotelian thought in the late Middle Ages. I don't know that that's, in some ways I can think of that being better, and in some ways maybe not so much. What we could look to as an example of a culture that is not shaped by Platonism is Jewish culture. So the Jewish emphasis on education, on responsible sexuality and reproduction, on how they raise their kids. So if you have any Jewish friends, notice how sometimes their lives are at odds with the forces of Christian society. Those are the friction points. And I personally admire Jewish culture very highly for many of those exact reasons, because they haven't been shaped in the way that Christian culture has by Plato's thought and that two-world solution. Sorry, going on too long, because I told you would get me excited about this, because I love to talk about this. And I will be happy to talk more over coffee as well. And I leave you with these words from the Reverend Barbara Peskin, now retired out in La Crosse. Because of those who came before, we are. In spite of their failings, we believe. because of and in spite of the horizons of their vision, we too dream. Let us go remembering to praise, to live in the moment, to love mightily, to bow to the mystery. I invite you to join and greet your neighbors. Hello to one another.
Hello, neighbor.